And I'll introduce him to you, how he introduces himself to us. Nebuchadnezzar was a man who wrote a lot. There's a ton of stuff that we have outside the Bible that Nebuchadnezzar wrote. And here's his introduction. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the exalted prince, the favorite of Marduk, that was a god of the Babylonians, the lofty ruler, the beloved of Nabu, another god. So apparently Nebuchadnezzar was the favorite, the judge, the possessor of wisdom, who searches out the ways of their divinity, who fears their lordship, the untiring officer who thinks daily of the adornment of the cities of Babylonia, and who concerns himself with pious works for Babylon, the wise, the pious, the restorer of the cities of Babylonia, the firstborn son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon, am I. Nebuchadnezzar was 29 when he became king of Babylon, and under his leadership, Babylon became a huge world power. His father had given Babylon independence, but Nebuchadnezzar took them on to be the dominant world power at the time. In 597, he took Judah, he defeated Judah, he took captives from Judah, and that's what a lot of the Old Testament is written about. In 568, he defeated Egypt, which was a first for any Babylonian king. Egypt itself was a superpower at the time. He defeated many, many more nations so that he expanded the reach of Babylon, and he secured Babylon with these huge walls. They were walls that were so impenetrable, so large, they were 90 kilometers long, and they were so thick that they used to have chariot races along the tops of the walls. They were impenetrable. There were multiple layers of them. And so inside, they lived in security, largely. He was also an architect and a designer, and Nebuchadnezzar, while he's known as a mighty man of war, he's known even more as a great man of peace. During peace times, he turned his attention to, as he said there in his little introduction, to adorning the cities of Babylonia. He was an architect, he was a designer, he built multiple canals and temples and bridges. He made, or supposedly made, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And he built the processional way leading to the Ishtar Gate. Now, I had a photo of that, but you should look this up if you haven't seen it before. The Ishtar Gate was the big gate on the north side of the city through which people came into the city of Babylon. It's made all of blue brick. It's this amazing and sort of unprecedented structure, which has been recreated and is now in a museum in Berlin. And under Nebuchadnezzar, the people of Babylon flourished. There were an abundance of schools. There was great strides made in mathematics. There was a lot of religious tolerance and diversity, unprecedented levels of religious tolerance. Lots of religions practiced in Babylon. There was a great amount of peace, and there was leisure within the city that the people could enjoy. And Nebuchadnezzar was not at all shy about his goal in doing all of this. In his military conquests, and to a greater extent, in what he did, in what he built in Babylon, he was not shy at all about why he did it. So there's an inscription that they've recovered on one of the sides of the Ishtar Gate, which says this: "I, Nebuchadnezzar, laid the foundation of the gates down to the ground level and had them built out of pure blue stone. Upon the walls in the inner room of the gate are bulls and dragons, and thus I magnificently adorned them with luxurious splendor for all mankind to behold in awe." He wanted to create a city that would be the awe of many nations, that he would be glorified as a result of that, and he was largely successful in that. Sir Rawlinson, who was one of the excavators of the area of Babylonia in the 1800s, recorded that 9 out of 10 bricks that they recovered are stamped with the name Nebuchadnezzar. And so he commented and said, "I've examined the bricks belonging to perhaps 100 different towns and cities in the neighborhood of Baghdad and have never found any other legend than that of Nebuchadnezzar, son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon." So he was the greatest king in the greatest city, the greatest kingdom that the world has seen. He was a king who had destroyed nations with their gods. He had built this wondrous city for all to glory in. He had been successful in all of this. And the final words that we have recorded from Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible are these: "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Now, you don't make a shift like that. You don't make a shift from this sort of, this king who is worshipped and adored and is just wanting glory for himself, to a king who now worships and extols another god, another king, who is humbled by this king. You don't get to that point simply by hearing a convicting sermon. You don't change that way just by listening to a Sunday school class. Nebuchadnezzar had to go through the absolute ringer with God. God put him through his paces, and he wrote about what happened to him in this chapter of Daniel. It's a strange little piece of the Bible because it's a pagan king writing a letter, and it's recorded here in the Jewish scriptures, this King Nebuchadnezzar. And I want to pick up on a couple of things that Nebuchadnezzar learned about God in the passage that we've had read here. The first is that control, that the sense of control that we have is an absolute illusion. That's the first thing that Nebuchadnezzar learned, that this innate sense that we have, that we can actually affect the outcomes of our lives, of our days, of our weeks, of our years, of our lives, is an illusion. We are not in control. The biggest lie that we buy into is this sense that if I do this, if I do A, it's going to result in B. If I do such and such, this is going to happen. We don't have control. That's the first thing Nebuchadnezzar learned. Have a look at verse 4 if you've got the passage open. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 4. He opens and says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. He was at ease and prospering. Everything up until this point had fallen very well for Nebuchadnezzar. There were nations on the face of the earth who made great claims about the power of their kings and the power of their gods and said, our God can defend us from anyone. But Nebuchadnezzar would come up against them and never would they pose a challenge to him. He conquered every nation he came against, every king, every god, over and over and over again. And he had created this great taxation system whereby the cities and the nations that he had conquered would pay tribute to Babylon, and he would use that and just funnel it straight into his building projects. And so here he is in this wonderful city, at ease and prospering. And for many of us, I think for us by and large in Australia, that phrase should really grab us, that we are at ease and prospering. At ease and prospering. Because the descriptions that we read of Babylon are eerily similar to the descriptions of the world that we inhabit, right? There is war is far away. We largely have peace. We've got also this religious and ethnic diversity. We hear about these things on the news, about the world going to custard, but right here, it's okay day by day. By and large, we're at ease and prospering. And we're indulging in a lot of leisure. We're indulging in, according to the ABS, about 4 hours of sedentary leisure per day. That's 4 hours of just sitting down and chilling. 4 hours of just watching TV, spending time on Facebook, playing video games, reading the news, talking to family. We are at ease and prospering. And it's easy in these kinds of conditions to fool ourselves into thinking that we actually possess some kind of control, right? Because the chaos of the world is far away. We know where the next meal is coming from. We don't have any great enemies coming against us. So it's very easy for us to think that we can actually control our environment, that there's actually order. But then there are moments in which that illusion is completely shattered, isn't it? There are those moments. I don't need to tell you about them because we've experienced them in the church, right? Over the last weeks, over the last months and years, we've seen it happen over and over again. We've seen these moments in which this illusion that everything's just going to continue the way it has always continued, that's shattered, and we recognize that we're not in control at all. And that was Nebuchadnezzar's experience. In verse 5, so he's at ease and prospering. In verse 5 it says, I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So here's a great king in control of his environment, at ease and prospering. He sees a dream, and now he's afraid and he's alarmed. And that can be true for any one of us. We're on that kind of knife edge, right? We've seen it happen in multiple ways in our church, but it's true that every single one of us is just one phone call away of our lives completely changing, aren't we? Just one piece of bad news away from it all shifting, from the sand shifting under our feet. And so Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. And he sees in the dream this amazing tree. It's reaching so high, it's reaching into heaven, and the leaves are beautiful. It's filled with splendor, and you can imagine that Nebuchadnezzar would have admired this, being a man who enjoyed his sort of aesthetic beauty. He's looking on this tree, he's thinking, what a wonderful tree. It's providing shade to creatures, to beasts underneath. And then this mysterious being, in the original language here, and this is written in a Chaldean language, not in the Hebrew language, the word is a watcher, a mysterious being, a holy one. This watcher comes and announces with a loud voice in verse 14, "Chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches." And he says, "But leave a stump." Oh, that's the inscription on the Ishtar gate. Go back to the one before just so we can see it. So that's the thing. There's a whole way called the processional way leading up to it, made of the same stone. And this is a reconstruction made largely from the same materials that they've recovered, and is on display there in Berlin in the Pergamon Museum. You can skip on to the black slide now. So he sees this decree of the watcher. The watcher says, "Cut down the tree, but leave the stump." And then in verse 15 and 16, you got to think Nebuchadnezzar starts to get a little bit nervous when the watcher starts talking about the stump not as an it, but as a he. All of a sudden, he starts using this pronoun. Verse 15 there, the second part. "Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let seven periods of time pass over him." And then we get the reason that he's been given this sentence, verse 17. "The sentence is by decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives them to whom he will and sets over them the lowliest of creatures." And so Nebuchadnezzar calls to his friend Daniel. Daniel was one of the original exiles from Judah, and he was a young man when he came out. And he had a reputation with Nebuchadnezzar and with the rulers of Babylon as being a guy who could interpret dreams. He was a guy who was really in touch with God and was able to interpret dreams. And so Nebuchadnezzar goes to Daniel. And Daniel comes in and basically says to Nebuchadnezzar, "This dream is way more literal than you would have hoped. You may have hoped that there was some kind of symbolism here, but it's basically exactly what you heard. You are that tree. You're going to get chopped down. You're going to become an animal for seven periods of time, or for 7 years." And he gives him this counsel in verse 27. He says, "In light of this, king, let my counsel be acceptable to you." Verse 27, "Break off your sins by practicing righteousness and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity." I don't think Daniel's holding out much hope. He's already said this is a decree of God. This is going to happen. And now he gives these sort of generic suggestions. Okay, break off the unrighteousness, do the right thing, and maybe there'll be a lengthening of your prosperity. But it's basically said this is going to happen. This dream is going to come upon Nebuchadnezzar. This horrific fate where all at once Nebuchadnezzar's family and his friends, his wife, the city that he loves, Babylon, and his sanity, it's all going to be taken at once. Everything that he loves is going to be taken from him at once, and he's going to be driven out to live among the animals. Now, let me at this point just remind you of how Nebuchadnezzar begins this letter in chapter 4. Take a look with me back in the first verses here to his greeting. It says, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. Now you'd expect after that kind of greeting, he's setting it up as saying, I'm going to tell you the amazing things God has done for me. Let me tell you the wonders that God has done in my life. You'd expect that for a king like Nebuchadnezzar, he's going to go on to talk about military conquest. He's going to go on to talk about how God has provided for him. If we started a sentence like that, what would we follow it with? The amazing things God has done. What's God done for my family? Check out how my kids are going. Look at this job I got. Look at the amazing things God has done. But what Nebuchadnezzar is going to go on to detail after this is the worst event of his life. And he calls it an amazing work that God has done. Look how amazing God is. He made me insane. He dragged me off from my family, from my friends, from the city that I loved. Because Nebuchadnezzar understood, and he was a man, in my research, he was a man who was very in touch with his religion. He was very in touch with looking for evidences of the divine. And you see in the book of Daniel, he's a man who really searches these things out and considers them seriously. He's a man who understands that this act of God was, while it was a judgment, was also an act of amazing mercy in his life. He understood, and we should understand, that when God shatters an illusion of ours, when God takes a lie that we're believing and tells us the honest truth, that is very good news. That is a merciful thing, even though it really hurts in the process, even though it can be horribly painful. When God shatters an illusion, it's always an act of mercy. Nebuchadnezzar had bought into this lie that he was in control of his environment. And we buy into the same thing, I think, all the time. All the time we imagine in our lives, okay, I'm going to go here, I'm going to go there, I'm going to move over here. Next week I'm going to do this. Next year I'm going to be over here. And James tells us in his letter in the New Testament, he says that making plans like that is boasting. Even making plans, even saying next year I'm going to go do this. Or when this happens, when my kids grow up, when this occurs, when I move over to this place, when I get this job, when I have this much money, all of that is boasting because it's claiming for ourselves a power that only God has, the power over the direction of our lives. And when we live like that, we're living against the grain of how God created the world to be. We're living against the grain of how God created us to be as creatures. And that leads to frustration. What we end up doing, if we live in a way that suggests to us that we're actually in control of our environment, we start dedicating tons and tons of thought energy to things that are completely out of our control, right? We start being consumed with events and circumstances that are completely beyond us. Or we start to blame ourselves for things that were beyond our power in the first place, that we could never take control of. Or we attempt to manipulate people. And we think, if I say these words in this sequence, in this way to this person, maybe they'll do that, and then that person will do this, and then the events will play well for me. And so we concoct these schemes. We think of how we're going to weight our words. We become little politicians. That's what happens when we think we're in control of our circumstances. Or, as Nebuchadnezzar did, we start to take credit for things that God did for us, that God did in us. We start to take credit for the skills and gifts that we have, for our circumstances in life, for the amount of wealth that we have, for the kind of spiritual life we have, whatever it is, we start to take credit for those things because we think that we're in control. And so, consider now just quickly how much we do spend doing those things, or how much we do spend actually thinking about ourselves in the quiet life of our mind, how much of our thoughts are dedicated toward thinking about ourselves, thinking about the last conversation we had and how we could have had it better, thinking about the things that we have to do tomorrow, what we're going to do next year, thinking about how we're perceived by other people, or thinking about the things that we deserve, the things that we're owed, the things that haven't been given to us that should have been. These are markings of a people, us, who have taken control of our own lives, who think that we're actually running this thing. But we're not designed to live like that. And so God is going to teach us from time to time, periodically, that we're not in control at all. And so Nebuchadnezzar was preserving this kingdom that was always supposed to be temporary. He was trying to make it eternal, and he was taking credit for a kingdom that God had made for him. And so in his mercy, God set him straight. Which leads me to the second and last thing I just want to draw out of Nebuchadnezzar's learnings here. And that is that God is in total control. That God doesn't just teach us to know our place, but he also teaches us to know God's place. And this was a huge theme in Nebuchadnezzar's life, actually, this teaching that not only is he completely out of control, but God is firmly in control. And so the beginning of the book of Daniel is set up with this little sentence about how when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah, he took off the treasures of the temple and he brought them to Babylon. This suggestion that Nebuchadnezzar had thought, because he had defeated the people of God, he had defeated God, he had defeated Yahweh, he was better than God. And the rest of the book of Daniel, at least as it applies to Nebuchadnezzar, is God teaching him the exact opposite. God's setting the record straight. And so in those early chapters, Nebuchadnezzar receives his first dream. Some of you will remember it, in which he sees this statue. And it's got a head of gold and the rest of the body is made of these other materials. And it symbolizes Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, the head of gold, but then these other kingdoms that are going to supersede it and take over it. And then in the midst of the dream, he sees a divine hand cut a rock out of the mountain, and the rock sort of rolls down and grows into a boulder and smashes the whole statue to pieces. And then that rock becomes a mountain. And the teaching is very simple and very clear for Nebuchadnezzar. Your kingdom is completely temporary. You can try and set it up. You can do your best with what you have. But God is in charge of when you rise and when you fall. God is in complete control of that. And then in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar gets a sign to the same effect. He's built this large statue. He built a statue that was 27 meters high, that was an image of himself in some way. And he called on all the peoples of the earth to bow down to this statue and pay homage. And the people of God, Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, defied the king's command. So he threw them into a furnace. You remember the story. And they survived. And again, the teaching is really clear to Nebuchadnezzar. You can light a furnace. You can heat it 7 times hotter than you normally heat it. You can chuck the people of God into it. But God decides when you live and when you die. And now this final lesson, the dream that comes true. Have a look at verse 28 with me. Verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" And then God, a voice from heaven, from God, interrupts him. Verse 31, "While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And you shall be made to eat grass like an ox. And 7 periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives them to whom he will." And so this king, who in other parts of the Bible, it talks about Nebuchadnezzar having such sovereign reign that even the animals, the beasts, the birds were given under his care. Now this great king becomes an animal, becomes a sort of horrible hybrid of the animals. He's eating like an ox. He's got feathers and claws like a bird. He's given the mind of an animal. And it may interest some of you to know, can I just grab the next slide there, Dennis, that there is some historical corroboration for this, potentially. There was a fragment found in 1975, and because it's a fragment, it's quite unclear, and they're not exactly sure what it applies to. But it may give support for this bout of insanity that Nebuchadnezzar had. Flick to the next one there. You see that it says there, "Nebuchadnezzar considered, his life appeared of no value to him. He does not show love to son and daughter. Family and clan do not exist. His attention was not directed towards promoting the welfare of Babylon. He prays to the Lord of Lords. He raised his hands in supplication. He weeps bitterly to Marduk, the great gods. His prayers go forth to..." And that's all we got. This is a Babylonian fragment talking about Nebuchadnezzar, or some suggest about his son. And if you contrast that with that first little introduction that he gave, of himself, where he's talking about, I'm the king of Babylon. I'm constantly anxious about Babylon. I want to adorn Babylon with all of this great thing. I'm giving constant concern and care to Babylon. And now you read about how he's showing no love to his daughter. His attention is not directed toward Babylon. There's some suggestion that this might be some corroboration for this bout of insanity. And a lot of historians do take that seriously, but obviously don't insert the biblical reason why that happened. Close the parenthesis there, flick onto the black. So he goes insane for 7 years, loses his mind, has the mind of an animal, and at the end of the allotted time, in verse 34 there, it says, "At the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever." Nebuchadnezzar at this point has no frustration with God. He's not angry with God. He doesn't get straight up and pout and cry and throw a tantrum, because he's learned some really deep truths that are hidden for all of us in plain sight all the time. He's learned these deep, deep truths that have existed as long as the universe. Have a look there at the end of verse 34. He says, "For his dominion," God's dominion, "is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can say to his hand, can stay his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?'" Do you have a vision of God that's like that? Do you have a vision of God in your mind, in the way that you relate to God, that's like that? This God who's so utterly beyond us and out of our control. Because if God is just a figment of our imagination, right? If God is just sort of in our minds and we all agree together in this delusion that is called God, then we can add and we can take away things, we can change things about his character, we can say, no, God wouldn't do this, or God would do this, or God's more loving than that. We can say all of those things. But if God is real, if God actually exists outside of us, beyond us, and created us, then he's terrifying, right? He is terrifying. He is a God for whom history is stretched out before him. He's seen kings come and go. He's seen everything that's occurred, everything that's happened. And he sees every one of our hearts laid bare, right? He sees all the dark corners of our heart, past every self-justification that we have that maybe satisfies us, allows us to sleep at night, maybe satisfies our loved ones. He sees past all of that to the very core of who we are. Before this God, we're accounted as nothing, right? We are creation. He is the creator. There is no comparing those two things. He has the power to do whatever he pleases. No one can stop him from doing what he wants to do. And he can change our lives, right? He can reach in at any point and completely alter our circumstances. He can give, he can take away, and all without doing us any injustice. If that's true, that's terrifying. And yet, to approach God like this is to live with the grain of how God created the world to be. He is our creator, we are his creation. This is exactly how we should approach our God. And there's a certain relief in that, I think. There's a relief in recognizing that there's no power on earth outside of his control, right? No single power, no molecule that is outside of the control of God. And it would have been a great comfort, I'm sure, to the Jews to read this story about Nebuchadnezzar, their great opponent, their greatest enemy, being subdued by God, God doing a work in him to change him. It gives me comfort to know that, yeah, God can see past all my self-justification. He can see my heart laid bare. But that also means he can untangle some things in my brain that even I don't understand. He can see some stuff. He can get real with me when I'm not willing to get real with myself. And it's also comforting to know that God, who's been around from generation to generation, who's seen thousands and thousands of years of human history, is playing the long game, right? So 7 years in God's sight for Nebuchadnezzar to go insane to learn this lesson, not a big deal. And in our lives, God is seeing eternity stretched out. He's aware of where we're going to be, not just in 10 or 15 years, but in 1,000 years. And he's playing the long game. He's preparing us for that. And if he's good, as all of these stories attest, as the story of Nebuchadnezzar attests to, as all of these stories that we've gone through in different ways, they all attest to the fact that God is good, that God is interested in our flourishing, that God is interested in humans. If God is good, he's a God who is worth praying to. He's a God who's worth orienting our entire lives around. He's a God who is worth trusting. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar learned. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honour the King of Heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. God's worth trusting. Let me pray. Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. Forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the power, the glory, the dominion forever and ever.